Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of January. Our guest is the author of the cover story in the Atlantic Monthly for this month, After Iraq, a Report from the Middle East and a Glimpse of Its Possible Future. Jeffrey Goldberg is our guest. He's an Atlantic national correspondent and is the author of Prisoners, a Story of Friendship and Terror. He spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East, in Iraq, Jordan, the West Bank, and Israel, and spoke with all kinds of experts in that part of the world. And it's a very thorough, interesting article. Let me just give you a Well, it kind of summarizes it in some parts of the article. As America approaches the fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the list of the war's unintended consequences is without end, as opposed to the list of intended consequences, which is so far vanishingly brief. The list includes notably the likelihood that the Kurds will achieve their independence, that Iraq will go the way of Gaul and be divided into three parts, but it also includes much more than that. Across the Middle East and into South Central Asia, the qualities of several states have been brought into focus by the omnivorous American response to the attacks of 9/11. It's not just Iraq and Afghanistan that appear to be incoherent amalgamations of disparate tribes and territories. The precariousness of such states as Lebanon and Pakistan, of course, predates the invasion of Iraq, but the wars against al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and especially Saddam Hussein have made the durability of the modern Middle East state system an open question in ways that it wasn't a mere 7 years ago. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and I'm sure we'll have many for Jeffrey. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Jeffrey. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. You start with, and I'm wondering why you start the article with this this al-Qaeda terrorist named Omar, and it's quite a chilling story here. Why do you start with that?
That's the story of an Arab terrorist who was caught by the Kurdish intelligence services in northern Iraq and who undergoes a thorough interrogation, let's say, unorthodox interrogation. I started it because I left that that meeting, and you could read about it in The Atlantic. I don't have to go through the whole story. I left that thinking about the deep hatred between the Kurds and the Arabs. I mean, it's one of the things that we in America don't fully understand is that Iraq really is a multi-ethnic society. The Kurds are not Arabs. They make up 25% or so of the country, control about a third of the territory. And they're not Arabs, and they actually have quite a lot of resentment toward the Arabs. And it struck me as a kind of obvious example of something that happens in a lot of Middle Eastern countries, in which you have very different kind of tribes, let's say, pulled together in the same, in the same borders, who really don't like each other and are would be looking for ways to get out if they could find them. And obviously, the Kurds right now are the leading candidates in the Middle East for breaking away from the existing state that they're in.
And you write that they really are functionally independent already.
Oh man, it's unbelievable. I mean, you cannot find the Iraqi flag flying up there.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, they have the Kurdish flag flying up there. It's almost as if they've seceded from the Union, let's say. The kids don't speak Arabic. They speak Kurdish. They're not being taught Arabic anymore, which of course is the language of 2/3 of Iraq. They're gone. Psychologically, I guess you would say they've already left the building. They haven't left it formally, and there's obviously leaving it formally would not be easy, and there's obviously an open question of whether it would be wise, especially if they left without taking some of the oil revenue with them. As far as an issue of whether it's just or not, the Kurds have been oppressed for 80 years by the Arabs of Iraq, particularly obviously in the last 20 years under Saddam Hussein. And so the cause is legitimate. It's just the question is whether it would be a clever thing to do or not.
Did anybody, when we went into Iraq, was this one of the goals here to allow the Kurds to achieve their independence?
Weirdly not. I mean, we talk all the time about how the neoconservatives who provided a lot of the, ideological fuel, I guess, for this war are Trotskyites in their belief in the permanent revolution. But they're actually quite statist in a kind of way. I've always been struck by the fact that they believe quite strongly, as does the State Department and the White House, in the importance of keeping Iraq unified. And it seems to me, I mean, this is just sort of an idle observation, but if you're going to upset the apple cart, you might as well upset it in a constructive way, and that might mean opening the question of whether Iraq should stay as a unified country. I mean, the thing to remember, of course, is that it's a very artificial country. It was created by essentially Winston Churchill one afternoon, sitting in front of a map.
Oh my!
You know, right after World War One, mm-hmm. when the British essentially roped together three Ottoman territories, three territories of the former Ottoman Empire that had just been defeated, and said, "We need a name for it. Let's call it Iraq." Hmm. And there you go. I mean, it's not. It did not evolve organically. Mm-hmm. Let's say so. So anyway, yeah, it's a very interesting point about you know, we think all the times about how the goal of the administration was to really rock the Middle East to its foundations and shake it out in a kind of way that would be better for the Middle East, better for us. But here they are, and they're completely committed to maintaining Iraq as a unified country when it might not be able to stay together anyway.
Yeah. The most important first-order consequence of the Iraq invasion, envisioned by many of those you spoke to, and you spoke to many, yeah, the possibility of a regional conflict between Sunnis and Shiites for theological and political supremacy in the Middle East.
Right.
And this could really change the whole makeup of the Middle East.
Well, that's the biggest story of all in a kind of way. Besides the fact that you have, the rise of Sunni fundamentalism, which led to 9/11, that's obviously the most, from our perspective, the most important thing that's ever happened in the last several years. But you have this growth of Shiite radicalism. I mean, the Shiites until 1979, during the Iranian Revolution, were what people in the field called quietists. You know, they were focused on prayer, and they weren't very political. And then Ayatollah Khomeini came along and radicalized the Shiites. And this, of course, scared the majority Sunnis, who were used to having the Shiites in kind of a subservient position, if you will. I guess that's a fair way of putting it. And ever since then, we've been dealing with the consequences of this Shiite revival. And the most telling sort of comment about this, I think, was that of King Abdullah of Jordan, who warned, a couple of years ago already, who warned about a Shiite crescent that would run from Tehran all the way to Beirut and then down into the Gaza Strip, and said, this is a national security crisis for Sunnis. Mm-hmm. And so what the Bush administration has done inadvertently by not managing this war very well, obviously, is to empower Shiites in a way that makes our Sunni allies upset. I hope that's not all too confusing, but it's really fascinating.
And what are the consequences of that?
The consequences are that look, our main friends, the states that we're mainly friends with, are Sunni governments: Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. Anything that threatens them threatens us, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
From a perspective of, let's say, the State Department or from the White House. Obviously, these are people who, among other things, supply us with a great deal of our oil. If the Sunnis are challenged unduly by the Shiites, that could have a widespread destabilizing effect on the Middle East, and that would lead to, among other problems, threats to our oil supply.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, when we talk about the consequences of the war, the biggest consequence so far, I think, has been the empowerment of Iran, and that was not what was obviously intended.
And if we decide to confront, not that we haven't, but even more forcefully than we have, Iran, you say that it could have a long-term impact on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. So it's all connected.
I mean, look, everything is connected. Mm. I mean, I tend to think that the biggest story in the Middle East is not the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. It's two other things. It's the Shiite-Sunni confrontation, if you will, and it's the relationship between Arab dictatorships and their people. That's that. Out of that problem, of course, came 9/11. But yes, I mean, obviously, Iran as everyone acknowledges, even the Europeans, and certainly the Sunni Arabs acknowledge, Iran plays a very destabilizing role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A powerful Iran means a more unstable Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Iran sponsors Hezbollah and Hamas, the two main organizations opposing, among other things, America's efforts to bring the Israelis and the Palestinians together. And so a powerful Iran means a lot of different things for the Middle East, and from our perspective, not much good.
What are the states that you see could shrink, fracture, or disappear in the next 20 years?
Well, obviously Iraq. We've talked about that. There's a good chance, and we're, this is extending beyond the borders of the Middle East, but it's part of the Muslim world. Pakistan is a very artificial creation, as many of your listeners know. And obviously Pakistan, from everything that you read, if nothing else, does not convey a sense of stability right now. There are nationalist movements in the different Pakistani states already. You could look at Lebanon and ask a question about Lebanon's future as an independent state. Syria has always believed that Lebanon is part of Syria. And that's something that could happen. Obviously, you know, one of the questions that people always ask, people have asked even before 9/11, is the stability of the Saudi regime. The family that runs Saudi Arabia obviously has challenges before it. As long as oil prices are very high, and I guess they're going to stay high for a while, the Saudis and the other Gulf states can buy off their populations to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's a lot of things that there's a lot of things that could change. Obviously, Iraq is the epicenter of this.
I know you had a conversation with Musharraf some time ago, Jeffrey. What stays with you from that conversation?
What stays?
Yeah.
Well, actually, what stays with me from that conversation is not something I put in this article, something I put in another article.
Ah.
But I'll tell you, because it was very relevant now. I asked him about the safety of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Obviously, it's a concern in a military dictatorship that, you know, who's got their fingers on the button.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, don't worry about it. And I said, well, sorry, you know, I'm a worrier. You know, just help me out. You know, help me out here. And he said, well, we have good command and control. And among other things that we do, we keep the nuclear warheads in one place and the missiles in another, like 50 miles away. And I left that conversation thinking, well, okay, so then what you would need then is a truck, you know? And
right.
It just didn't make me feel confident in the systems that Pakistan has in place to ensure that fundamentalists don't get hold of these weapons.
Let's spend just a few minutes before we go to phone calls on Egypt and what's been happening with Palestinians pouring into that country. Why isn't Egypt more welcoming?
More welcoming to what?
The Palestinians.
Well, that's a whole separate conversation. This is a question I often ask myself as someone who believes that the creation of an independent Palestinian state would be in the best interest of everyone, meaning the Palestinians, the Israelis, and the Americans, among others. You know, the Arab states for years and years and years have talked about their solidarity with the Palestinian people. But if you actually look at who pays for the welfare of the Palestinians, it's America, it's Western Europe. The Gulf states in particular, I can't really put all the blame on Egypt here. The Gulf states right now, think about this, and I'm sure you've dealt with this on other shows. The Gulf states have so much money. They have more money than anyone has ever had in history. I mean, Abu Dhabi alone, I think, and Dubai together probably have more than $1 billion in cash. A trillion dollars in cash. I didn't mean a billion. Abu Dhabi, I think, has $800 billion in cash sitting around waiting to invest in things. The money just comes in too quickly.
Huh.
I mean, when you go to the, you know, when you every time you fill up your tank, you know, boom. You're making someone in the Middle East very rich. And given all the language, given all the talk about Palestinians, solidarity of the Palestinians, you'd think that they would spend a little bit more money on building better housing and providing better care for the Palestinians. The Egyptians obviously are in a bit of a pickle here. They express solidarity to the Palestinians, but they don't want any Palestinians
right.
in their country.
Right.
And so you have this kind of crazy situation at the Palestinian-Egyptian border, in which Palestinians ripped through the border in order to get into Egypt. Egypt is trying to corral them back in kind of harsh ways, with tear gas and batons and water cannons and all that sort of thing. And obviously, if Egypt can get control over that border in some way and regularize the movement between Gaza and Egypt, it would be better for everyone. But Egypt, as you know, is not a high-functioning state. Mm-hmm. Look, we can't even – this is not a value judgment on the immigration debate, but we have a hell of a time trying to even manage the flow of people between the United States and Mexico, two countries that are not at war and are allies. So, you know, I have some sympathy for the Egyptians in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, when you look at it, when you talk to the people, some of whom were responsible for going into Iraq,
yeah.
we had this sort of vague idea that the reason that we're there is to bring, you know, the shining light of democracy to this part of the world.
Yeah.
And it's hard to go much more beyond that, but that's what we've heard. Is that, when you talked to all of these people, was that a final goal here? And the second part of the question is, did everybody have a fairly deep understanding of what's going on with Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds and everybody else?
Well, look, I am. You're not going to get me to knock the idea of democracy. Obviously, I was just listening to it was Martin Luther King Day. I was just listening to some old speeches,
mm-hmm.
And there's that wonderful Martin Luther King quote: "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice."
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to, you know, I think it's foolish for any American to get on the other side of this democratic question. You know, is democracy the ultimate cure? Probably, yeah. I mean, true democracy would go a long way to easing the tensions in the Middle East. Did the people who planned, or I guess you would say not plan, the war have all of the complications in mind when they went in? No, mm-hmm. Absolutely not. They had, I guess you would say, a naive belief that once you lifted the boot, Saddam Hussein's boot, off the neck of the Iraqis, they would stand up, dust themselves off, and become like a Vermont town meeting. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, the people of Iraq were so damaged by this dictatorship that they weren't equipped to make the decisions and to do all the sorts of things that one has to do in order to build a democracy. So our crime, I think, was not planning this war and not considering that. I don't know. It just seems logical that when you plan something, you have to have a plan for when things go wrong, and that was the problem.
Jeffrey Goldberg is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls. One line is open if you would like to get it right now. He's national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, and we're talking about the January-February issue. He has the cover story, "After Iraq, What Will the Middle East Look Like?" Jeffrey is also author, and it's just been released in paperback, "Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror." Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the Senate Finance Committee is concerned about the rising cost of higher education. They have asked for detailed information from the country's 136 most affluent colleges and universities on several things: how they raised tuition over the last decade, how they gave out financial aid, and how they managed and spent their endowments, some of which are very, very hefty. We're going to have several people weigh in on this. Adjunct research fellow at the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. We will be speaking with an adjunct fellow also with a columnist for higher education, and also with the executive director of the Project on Student Debt. So that's all coming up. the second hour of our program today. Our lines are filled for Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. The January-February issue, the cover story is his, After Iraq, a report from the Middle East and a glimpse of its possible future. He's also the author of Prisoners, a story of friendship and terror, just released in paperback. Let's go to phone calls now. We go to Arlene from Milwaukee first. Jeffrey, hi, Arlene.
Hi. I think that even your guest has not taken into account the history of all of these countries. I think we're still suffering from the imperialism of the European countries and Great Britain foremost in Africa and the Middle East, and we will for centuries to come. Also, I believe that the intervention of the United States, the history of the United States in the Middle East has caused these problems. And the damage to the Iraqi people by the sanctions that were passed after the Middle East war that George Bush's father instigated. So I think that history plays an important part, and I hope that our next president is much more historically educated than this one was.
Jeffrey.
Well, as I said earlier, a lot of the problems of Iraq date back to Winston Churchill, as the caller said, devising a country, Iraq, not only Churchill, we shouldn't just blame Churchill, it's the British in general, devising a country that doesn't make a lot of sense geographically or ethnically, religiously also. It's true. I hesitate to I'm not so narcissistic as to think that we're responsible for everything in the world. There's a great deal of dysfunction in the Middle East that's organic to the Middle East. That said, it's true. We often support the wrong guys in the Middle East, and I think this in a way was the promise of George W. Bush's push for democracy in the Middle East, which is unfulfilled. You know, there was a time a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, where Democrats in the Middle East, small D Democrats in the Middle East, really thought that this time the Americans were going to be behind them and not behind the dictators. And it turns out that it wasn't so. This is a 50-year problem. It's not just George W. Bush's problem. It's a Democratic and Republican problem. But it's true. And as I'll go back to my earlier statement, I think that until there is democracy in the Middle East, you will have the same sort of problems you have now. That said, it's not so easy. We have to acknowledge that it's not so easy to get to democracy in the Middle East.
Thanks, Arlene, for your call. Jack from Elkhorn. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you again for a wonderful program. I'm looking forward to reading that article. I have a question for you. Do you think that America, both in political leadership and in the people themselves, will ever face up to what's been alluded to so many times in the previous conversation, that our efforts to go in and superimpose a political or an ideological system on people without any sense of the cultural and society factors that are against all that, it's just pure arrogance on our part. I think it's as arrogant as if we wanted to go in and superimpose Christianity on them. And if you look at the people, I'm all for democracy. I would wish the world would have a good democracy in every country, but our attempts to superimpose it and the arrogance on which that's based constantly cause problems, not only for the countries involved, but for us. And do you think that we'll ever have any people that really look at these countries and look at where are they societally and culturally? Are they ready for this any more than if we were just to go into some country and turn a village into a metropolis?
Jeffrey.
You know, it's a very interesting point. I mean, I think, look, I hope that lessons are learned out of this. Well, we all hope that certain lessons are learned. I hope that we don't, sorry for the cliche, but I hope we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. What I think the caller is suggesting is a kind of humility here. I would like to see us go back to the old sort of JFK model, if you will, of trying to be the shining city on the hill, being a good model for everyone. That's the most important thing, and B, to engage people gradually on these questions. you know, there are many people. We don't suppose that there aren't people in these countries who want their countries to be more like America. It's true, they do. That's why they try to come here in large numbers. But there's a way to teach or export the ideas of civil society, of rule of law, of a free press, of freedom of religion, in ways that are humble and gradual rather than forceful. We should not assume that everyone sees the truth of America as so obvious as we see it.
JFK is very much in the air this week,
no
isn't
boy,
he? Yeah, is he ever. Is he ever. Thanks, Jack, for your call. Let's go to Saeed from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am very pleased to hear that your speaker is understands that the fundamental problem in the Middle East is a deficit of democracy. It's very arrogant of Americans that whenever we talk about democracy, they think that it is something American that is being exported. Whereas a striving for freedom is a basic human need, the Iranians don't need democracy training. Anyone who follows the struggle of the Iranian people closely understands that there are many, many Iranians who understand what the struggle for freedom is, who fight despite tremendous risks to their lives, who go to prison, who get tortured, who get killed, who demonstrate in the streets, and here is a country that has, first of all, the Khomeinis in Iran are principally responsible for much of the trouble, they are presiding over a nation that has struggled for over 100 years since the constitutional revolution in Iran in 1906 for freedom, for self-governance, and that though we have spent all the resources and efforts in Iraq, the country that is ripe for a populist overthrow of the fundamentalist Khomeinist is Iran.
All right, let's get a response, Saeed. Jeffrey?
Yeah, no, I mean it's interesting. I agree with the statement caller expressed at the outset about democracy not being a particularly American idea. It's a human idea. I think that we have something to offer. We have an independent judiciary that works. Court decisions in America are enforced without guns, and judges are, with some exceptions obviously, are fair and impartial and don't represent the interests of a dictator. And so we can teach lawyers how to do that, and we could teach people about the value of that system. On the Iran question, I agree, particularly on the point that that Iran poses a kind of unique challenge because the people are bursting, let's say, with democratic feeling, but they have a theocratic government sitting on top of them that is very frightened of modernity and such modern ideas to them as democracy. So, I mean, it's a very interesting point the caller makes.
Yeah. So, what do you do to with that bursting with democratic feeling? What can you do?
You mean as Americans?
Right.
We might have to do the un-American thing and just wait. no, I'm serious. That's,
right,
that,
yeah, I
that's
get you.
That's the thing, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I've learned over the last 5 years is that just because we want Muslims to do certain things doesn't mean that Muslims are going to go and do them. And you can't force people's hands there. You know, Persian civilization, I mean, we're pikers compared to the Persians. They've been around for thousands of years and been a mighty civilization with a culture and well-developed religious thought. I mean, this is not, you just can't go in and say, okay, guys, here you go. This would be a better way to do it.
Right.
I mean, we all hope, I think, for democratic change in Iran. And there are certain things you can do, like I was saying, in this sort of gradualist way. But we get in trouble sometimes when we try to force the issue.
Thanks, Saeed, for your call. Josh from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks. All right, Josh. Sure.
Well, I was wondering if Jeffrey could give us his take on the current crop of presidential candidates and who he thinks has the best and most legitimate plan going forward for both Iraq and just general Mideast policy. And I'll take my question.
All righty, Jeffrey.
Yeah, 10 words or less, right? Look, I I'm a reporter. I'm trying not to, you know, I try not to express my opinions about these things. All of the main candidates are pretty impressive on these subjects. That said, I was just talking yesterday with someone about this. My feeling of depression that the crucial questions aren't being asked these days. I mean, look at the Democratic debate of the last week and a half. Shouldn't be talking about whether Obama is like Jesse Jackson or is he
exactly.
not like Jesse Jackson. I mean, we
right.
should be talking about and hearing from them.
Right.
What are you going to do with Pakistan?
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to manage a relationship with Pakistan come January 21st, 2009? And you know, I don't have enough information from these guys yet. I mean, I sort of know better what the Republicans think than the Democrats, tell you the truth. I think that we're obviously in a tough spot in Iraq, not as tough as it once was, because we obviously have a better strategy and a better general in there right now. I think running away would be foolish. I think staying also has its foolish qualities, let's say. But I think you know, this precipitous withdrawal that some people are talking about would lead to more chaos, not less chaos.
Mm. Jeffrey, take this where you want, but you do in the article say that America does now have the chance to help right some historic wrongs. For one thing, wrongs committed against the Kurds.
Yeah.
There are other peoples, of course, in the Middle East that the U.S. could stand up for
right.
if it weren't so committed to the preservation of the existing map.
Right. Look, I know this is not the right moment. I say this in the piece in The Atlantic this month. I know it's not the right moment to disinter Wilsonian idealism. People are pretty cynical these days. But let's take what President Wilson promised 90 years ago or however long it was. President Wilson, after World War I, promised the peoples of the Middle East autonomy and presumably eventual independence, including the Kurds. And I think one of the problems we've had with instability in the Middle East over the last 80, 90 years, is that those promises weren't fulfilled. And so what I was arguing, specifically in the Kurdish case, but, I mean, this can be extended out a lot further than just the Kurds, to as far away as Sudan, really. It's the idea that maps aren't holy, you know. God did not come down with his finger and draw the map of the Middle East in lightning before time. These states are man-made creations. Some of them are not fair to their minorities. And given that we've gone into the Middle East and ripped the lid off of Iraq, and it was an ugly lid, and it was, you know, Saddam was it. We always forget this when we talk about Iraq, is just how atrocious Saddam was. So we did a good thing for Iraq in that sense, but we didn't come in with a plan to make it better. And I'm just saying that there's a moment here that you can grab this moment and say, okay, now that everything's shaken up, let's help reorder it in a more just way. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Let's go next to Steve from Wapaka. By the way, we have a couple lines open. They've been busy. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's very important in a discussion like this to remember history correctly, because if we don't remember it correctly, we're going to make the same mistakes that we've made before. And I think one of the big things is now when you hear a lot of people talk about reasons for war, the first thing they mention is bringing democracy to the Middle East. Well, that's not how this war was sold to the American people. It bothers me when people act like we went in for the sole purpose of bringing democracy to the Middle East. Well, that was like added on as the benefit of invading Iraq. That was just the catchy thing to make it look good, but this war wasn't sold to the American people as bringing democracy to the Middle East. We were told that, you know, Saddam Hussein was out to get us, and he had weapons of mass destruction and all that. So I think both of you especially need to make sure you don't represent the idea that we went to war to bring democracy to the Middle East.
No, you know, Steve is right about that. It was one of four or five different reasons for going to war. It certainly wasn't the predicate cause. The predicate cause was the belief by the administration that Saddam posed a threat because of WMD to America and its allies. And by the way, to be fair, it was not just Republicans who believed that at the time. It was the Democrats as well. That turned out to be wrong. I don't want to get into whether it was it was lying or whether it was misinterpreting data or not having enough data. But you're right. I mean, WMD was the immediate cause of the invasion. But I think that President Bush, after 9/11, had in mind this radical and not incorrect notion that you can't just kill your way out of the terrorist problem, that you have to change fundamental realities in the Middle East so that people aren't drawn to terrorism anymore. And so that was there. But the caller has a very good point.
Jeffrey Goldberg is our guest. He is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and has the cover story of the January-February issue, which you can read online if you would like. It is titled After Iraq, A Report from the Middle East and a Glimpse of Its Possible Future. He's also the author of, just released in paperback, Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror. And we'll welcome more phone calls. We also have an email in case our lines have been busy this morning. If you want to send an email, and it's a good one, we'll read it on the air. It's talk@WPR.org. Our on-air number is 800-486-8655 or in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls at 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Dave from Madison, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I just want to, this is a great thing to talk about here. You know, the complexity of the issue of Sunni Shiites and things like that, it's just a good program. But I just wanted to expound on the last caller. You know, it would have been irresponsible as President Bush was in office to not do something about Iraq. And, you had Sunni dictatorship massacring Shiites. And I mean, after 9/11, I mean, we had to change the situation in the Middle East, and that's all there is to it. And even the entire Congress accepted that fact and voted on it. But you know, my question to you is Turkey. Is Turkey is a Muslim country. Are they Sunni or Shiite? And how do they somewhat make it work up there? And I'll listen offline.
All right, thank you.
Well, the short answer on Turkey is after World War I, Kemal Atatürk came into power and essentially tried to eradicate Islam as much as he could by force from his society, banning women from wearing the headscarves, banning men from wearing the fez. He secularized the country in ways that no longer are possible because it involved wholesale repression. Out of that came a more secular country, but Turkey is not so secular today. You see a Islamist revival a bit in Turkey. But I tend to think that Turkey isn't a useful model for the rest of the world because no one anymore is going to go in, no leader is certainly going to go into his country and say, okay, you have to stop believing what you believe.
Jim is next from Marinette. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I guess I'd like your guest's opinion on why we don't spend more of our time and money building up the economies of some of these countries. For instance, in what will eventually probably be Palestine. Why don't we go and build an automobile plant and subsidize it, or build textile mills and subsidize them.
I hate to break it to you, but at the Paris conference last month, and the Western countries, including the United States, committed $7.7 billion to help Palestine. That's on top of the $4 billion that was spent to no good effect in the 90s. I mean, the Palestinians are quite lucky in this regard in terms of the amount of Western aid. The more relevant question is what the Palestinians do with the aid when they get it. After the Israeli pullout in 2005 from right. Gaza, the Palestinians received a huge amount of money and could have built something, and they didn't. And Hamas came into power and started firing rockets into Israel. I mean, it's not. The caller's right. I mean, that you know, and he's thinking like an American. Like I think, like all of us think. Like let's be rational and let's build rather than tear down. But sometimes that just doesn't happen in the Middle East. And that's something that we need to sort of grapple with before we go about trying to change societies too radically.
Hmm. Same question, same answer when we look at Pakistan?
Pakistan is so complicated. Yeah. It's a sovereign country. There's a limited amount of stuff you can do in a sovereign country that's ostensibly an ally. You cannot make people behave in ways that conform to the American economic and political models. You simply can't make them do that. You can, over time, try to encourage it. But, a lot of times this is throwing good money after bad. And that's what I talk about by having to adopt this very un-American idea of waiting until people in the Middle East say, you know what, I've had enough of this way of doing things. I want to try a new way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim, so much for the call. Willie from Madison, hi.
Hi. First of all, I need to respond to the caller who talked about Bush had to do something about Iraq. The number we often heard from everybody was that Saddam had killed 300,000 of his people. I guess I would suggest a real poor solution to that was killing 600,000 to a million of them in response. I don't think the Iraqi people are ever going to love us for doing that. The caller, Saeed, said something interesting, and I was rather surprised because he talked about Iranian people want democracy, talked about back to the Constitution of 1906, stuff like that, yet failed to mention the reason Iranians don't have democracy now is because of what happened in 1953. They had an elected democracy. Unfortunately, there were some nationalist tendencies. They wanted to control their petroleum wealth, so of course the United States decided that Mohammad Mossadegh was a communist and they overthrew him. This whole conversation has been filled with the assumption that the United States favors democracy worldwide. My reading, obviously with a political viewpoint of U.S. history since the Second World War, seems to show in country after country after country, unless it's largely populated by white people, with the exception of Yugoslavia, even that way, the United States has no interest in democracy. We want to deter democracy everywhere. Chomsky, of course, has a book entitled Deterring Democracy, which I think is much more accurate history than I'm hearing now.
Jeffrey.
Well, I've heard that speech a million times, and I suggest you have Noam Chomsky on. I just sometimes repelled by the idea that Shiites kill Sunnis and Sunnis kill Shiites, and it's all America's fault. I think we have to stop juvenilizing, if you will, treating Middle Easterners as children. Assert that there's some responsibility for their own behavior. The Iranian point is not a bad one, by the way. It's true. Just because America has made a mistake 50 years ago doesn't mean that we have to keep, for consistency's sake, keep making those mistakes. And I think we're somewhat different than we were in 1955. I don't know. I find that argument sort of more of a talking point argument than something real.
Joe from Racine, hi.
Hi.
Hey.
Well, I have a different slant on that. The word democracy has been flipped around left and right, and I don't even think that the George Bush administration has a concept of democracy. What happened to the neocons' plan for the imperial United States? The road to Israel is from Baghdad, and the neocons' concept of their idea of how to run the Middle East.
Jeffrey?
I don't know. I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
Well, the question is that the neocons wrote a paper, and that was the new imperialism of the United States. And they obviously didn't succeed, but they wrote the paper. The neocons wrote the paper for the new imperialism of the United States.
Who's guiding the philosophy now behind whatever actions we're taking in the Middle East? We've heard a lot about the neocons. Who's fashioning our policy, Jeffrey?
No, I think now it's Condoleezza Rice and Gates and the Pentagon who are moving in a more, moving back in the direction of the first Bush presidency, George H.W. Bush, rather than George W. Bush, and the idea of putting the idea of, at least in the Iraq context, of confidence over ideology by putting Petraeus in, for instance, and supporting his mission. I think the downside of that is that we have stopped criticizing Arab regimes for their human rights abuses and other Muslim regimes, Pakistan, for instance, because we are aiming for stability once again rather than change. And that's not good. I mean, just talk to Arab dissidents in the Muslim world and you'll hear a critique of the way that's moving. But I think it's I tend to believe, as many people do, that we've made neoconservatism into a convenient scapegoat for everything that's happened. I think things are much more complicated than that. Right now I would say that it's certainly not the neoconservatives who are guiding the policy. I mean, one of the big questions of the last 7 years is who, if anyone, has been guiding policy? And that's an open question, and historians will be unpacking that one for years.
Yeah, well, it'd be nice if somebody were. I know you have to leave a little bit early. We thank you so much, Jeffrey, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Goldberg, he's the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Stay on the line, because we're just going to take your comments here in the last couple minutes of the program. The piece is After Iraq, A Report from the Middle East and a Glimpse of Its Possible Future. Jeffrey is also author of Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror. Our number remaining the same, 800-486-8655. Janice from Madison is our next caller. Have I pronounced your name correctly, Janice?
Yes, hello?
Yes, hi. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got the wrong... Oh, dear. Oops, we got the... I got mixed up here. Here we go. Janice from Madison. Hi, Janice.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I wanted to say that very often it is forgotten that the French put a veto against the war, the invasion of Iraq. And they usually... some Democrats have voted for the war, but we didn't really know. I'm pretty sure the French knew exactly what they were doing, and this is very often forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to mention that fact and maybe have a comment from your guest.
Yeah, I'm sorry the guest had to leave, but we appreciate your comment on that. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Amy from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, if we attacked Iraq because we believed that it was a threat and we ended up being wrong, as we know is the case, what right do we have to now try to impose our interests on the Iraqis? Why do we have a right to be a part of the process of the remaking of Iraq, of imposing laws that, say, govern its oil so that it benefits us? What right do we have? This is the ends justifying the means.
Mm. So what should we be doing?
Well, we should be providing more diplomacy and withdrawing.
Thanks, Amy, for your call.
Thank you.
Joe from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Joe.
Hey, hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for taking the call. Listen, you're one caller that called in who said we're not building democracy around the world. I really had a chuckle. He is so right on, and your guest over there hemmed and hawed for like a full 30 seconds trying to find the right words, because he hit it right on the head. When the Shah was replaced in Iran, and when the elected president was replaced in Guatemala prior to that, and the continuing series of CIA covert activity around the world in each country has not been democracy building. It's been building right-wing governments who constantly suppress their people. 200,000 people killed in Guatemala, and I could go on with country after country after country what this country's been doing. previously, about a week ago, one of your callers, who was a librarian or somebody, was talking about books. You mentioned Chalmers Johnson. She didn't even know who he was. That really struck me as odd, and I tried calling in, and I couldn't get in that particular day. Chalmers Johnson has a trilogy out called Blowback. Blowback is a CIA term talking about what happens with our covert activities in other countries and the effect it's having upon us. And this is going to continue throughout until people educate themselves about what this country has been doing in other countries, not democracy building. It's all bull.
All right, Joe, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
One more phone call. We only have about 30 seconds left. Derek from Grays Lake. Hi.
Yes, hi. I just would like to make a comment that this your guest's demeanor, speaking about this area, it reminds me of a sports commentator basically rooting for his favorite team, and I think it's really highly inappropriate. I would suggest that WP...
what was inappropriate about him? I don't get it.
The swagger, the way he's describing this, is more like a sports match game, sports commentator, that he's rooting for the right team. You know, these are people's lives who are being put in charge here and lost in the process. And I think Wisconsin Public Radio would do much better to invite to speak some type of professor for political science from Baghdad, Jordan, somebody who lives in the area, who actually knows the reality firsthand. He can tell us exactly how the foreign policy decisions made by this government really affect people.
All right.
On the ground.
I suggest, though, Derek, that you read his article. It's quite comprehensive.
Well, but I think the problem here is simply, you know, he's also factually very inconsistent. For example, 1920.
All right, wait, I'm sorry, we can't go back to 1920 because we've got to go to the news. But thank you very much for your call. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and then a really interesting hour on education and endowments and tuition and all of that. So stay with us for the next hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.